This week, former U.S. President Donald Trump was booked at the Fulton County, Georgia jail on 41 charges of attempting to overturn the state's 2020 presidential election results.
This is the most serious one for him politically. And the reason I say that is because they have him on tape talking about how he wanted to change the outcome of the election.
Who stood out in the first Republican debate leading up to the 2024 national election?
Well, I thought it was a very good night for Nikki Haley.
And the Russian Federal Air Transport Agency announced the death of Wagner Group leader Yevgeny Prigozhin. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was booked at the Fulton County, Georgia jail Thursday on 41 charges that he and 18 co-defendants participated in schemes to tamper with the state's 2020 presidential election results. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The first ever arrest photograph of a former U.S. president. Taken as Donald Trump was processed on charges alleging he participated in a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in the key swing state of Georgia. Trump told reporters later Thursday that his opponents were trying to derail his presidential nomination bid.
What they're doing is election interference. They're trying to interfere with an election. There's never been anything like it in our country before.
Trump, who is the current frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, is not under arrest and can still campaign. Todd Belt is director of the School of Political Management at the George Washington University.
This is the most serious one for him politically. And the reason I say that is because they have him on tape talking about how he wanted to change the outcome of the election.
At a prayer rally in Georgia this week, members of faith communities pushed back against calls to remove District Attorney Fannie Willis from her position because she is prosecuting Trump.
District Attorney Willis has demonstrated courage, integrity, and unyielding commitment to upholding the principles of justice that lie at the heart of our legal system.
Outside the courthouse Thursday, dozens of the former president's supporters criticized the charges. Trump supporter Anton Williams.
Our government, literally right before everyone's face, weaponized the justice system. This is crazy.
The president's former lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who is among the 18 co-defendants accused of a criminal conspiracy, said the charges were unjust.
This indictment is a travesty.
Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
On Wednesday, eight U.S. Republican presidential candidates participated in the first debate leading up to the 2024 national election. I spoke with Jim Kessler, political analyst and executive vice president of Third Way in Washington, about who stood out from the others on the stage.
Well, I thought it was a very good night for Nikki Haley, who is a candidate who's way down in the polls, who's the former governor of South Carolina and was part of the Trump administration and a foreign policy area. But, you know, she went head to head with Vivek Ramaswamy, who's sort of the fresh face out there, and really scored points. And I expect that she's going to get a little bit of a bump and people are going to start to look at her.
Also, in looking at Vivek Ramaswamy, there was a lot of controversy going into this debate with him. But really, how did he fare overall?
You know, you look at the commentators out there, and he's getting very mixed reviews. There are some folks who thought, like, he did great. And in some ways, he was the focal point of last night's debate because Donald Trump wasn't there. But he had bad moments where he looked amateurish and basically was schooled by some of the other people on the stage. And my experience with debates is your bad moments count more than your good moments. And ultimately, I expect he's going to get a lot of attention going forward. In some ways, he's irresistible to cover, but he showed his Achilles heel out there. And we'll see how long his moment lasts.
And looking at Ron DeSantis, did he do as well as his supporters thought he would do?
He had a performance that I would grade him a B, okay? He did fine. He didn't make mistakes. He had a couple of moments where he stood out. He didn't look like anything special. So I think if you're a Ron DeSantis supporter, you came away thinking like he did what he needed to do. But if you were not a Ron DeSantis supporter, you're probably still not a Ron DeSantis supporter. So I think for him, it was a little bit of a stasis performance.
And also, it turns out that former Vice President Mike Pence was the one who had the most minutes of talking on the stage. How does this look for Pence?
So if I was going to say what was the biggest surprise for me watching the debate, it was how well Mike Pence did. In some ways, he comes across as a very old-fashioned politician, but he came across as also kind of very principled. And then really the most important exchanges of the night, which was the question that Fox moderators asked is like, did Mike Pence do the right thing? He came out very, very strong. So I don't know if it's enough to change his fortunes in this election, but if the only result of this is changing the perception of Mike Pence as a candidate, he succeeded in doing that.
As you mentioned earlier, with former President Donald Trump not being there, for voters, when they're looking at these other Republican presidential contenders, at least on Wednesday night, this was a field without Trump. So what does this mean for voters when they're looking at Trump not being there?
I would contend that it was a bad night for Donald Trump. One of the things that really struck me watching the debate, he wasn't there and he wasn't missed. Like, this was an entertaining, two-hour, rollicking give and take that if you tuned in, you would think like, okay, there's real candidates out there with real differences. And Donald Trump has such a huge lead right now. And I think he made the right choice not to show up. He doesn't want to be one of nine on the stage. But you could look at that and say, there's a Republican Party after Donald Trump. And whether that's a Republican Party that's going to be after Donald Trump soon or later, this debate last night made you think like, well, maybe it's sooner than we think. So I don't think it was good news for Donald Trump. I expect you're going to start to see his national numbers decline a little bit. This is the moment where voters really start to pay attention. This was the starting gun, and he wasn't there, and it's going to hurt him.
Well, there's a CBS poll that came out earlier in the week before the GOP debate, and it found that 91% of likely GOP primary voters said they want the candidates to focus on making the case for themselves rather than going after Donald Trump. Do you think they did that?
What we saw is an audition, and I think that five of the eight candidates passed the audition. They should get another look. The three that did not, in my view, was Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, Asa Hutchinson, former governor of Arkansas, and Governor Bergen of North Dakota. But the other five, they were intriguing enough that voters will say, okay, I can see this person being president. I want to pay attention. And, you know, just one more thing on this. Voters right now have a series of candidates they could say, I could potentially be with that candidate. There are a lot of potential replacements for Donald Trump right now. So I think this was a good day for the non-Trump candidates out there.
And also just one last question. As you mentioned, they could be looking for an alternative, especially when you look at Donald Trump, his legal troubles. How are they going to play going forward into his campaigning?
Well, this is a place where Republican candidates have to change their tune. Oftentimes, what they start with is how the Justice Department has become politicized. I think they need to junk that. They need to say Donald Trump's legal problems are solely because of Donald Trump's behavior, and we can't excuse it any longer. And whether you think the Justice Department is politicized or not, if Hillary Clinton had done half of these things, we'd be chanting, lock her up. So his problems are his own and not the fault of anybody else. And those candidates have to make that case. Because if Republican voters don't believe that, none of these other candidates have a chance. So they've got to make that case.
That was Jim Kessler, political analyst and executive vice president of Third Way. The The Russian Federal Air Transport Agency officially announced the death of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the chief of the Russian mercenary organization known as the Wagner Group. Prigozhin was on the passenger manifest for the plane that crashed northwest of Moscow on Wednesday. Anna Rice has the story.
A private plane carrying Wagner Mercenary Group Chief Yevgeny Prigozhin crashed Wednesday, August 23rd, in the Tver region northwest of Moscow. Russian officials say Prigozhin, Wagner leader Dmitry Utkin, and Prigozhin's senior aide Valery Chikalov died in the crash, along with four other passengers and three crew members. Scott Lucas, a professor of international politics at the University College Dublin, says the crash was likely no accident.
Western intelligence agencies, not just the U.S., but European agencies, are sending out signals that it looks like that it was an anti-aircraft missile that took this down. Now, you know, what you then take is the next step. Unless you believe that a Russian anti-aircraft battery went rogue or that there was some type of, you know, horrible mistake, that's an ordered, an operation. That is a targeted assassination.
Russia's official state news agency TASS reported that an investigation has been ordered into the crash. The crash happened exactly 2 months after Prigozhin started a mutiny against Russia's military leadership that lasted roughly 24 hours. Prigozhin and his forces turned around before reaching Moscow and were subsequently permitted to relocate to Belarus. Andrei Karapkov, an expert in Russia teaching at Middle Tennessee State University, was not surprised at all by Prigozhin's death.
It's been exactly 2 months, and it's very symbolic. From the start, I kept saying Prigozhin is doomed. He's violated the most important Kremlin rule. He wasn't loyal to the leader. What happened 2 months ago was embarrassing enough for Putin, so this crash was to be expected.
On Thursday, Putin offered condolences to families of plane crash victims and said Prigozhin was a talented person who made some serious mistakes. Anna Rice, VOA News, Washington.
For more insight on Prigozhin's role as a mercenary leader, I spoke with Gil Barndollar, senior fellow at Defense Priorities in Washington. I asked him why Prigozhin was considered a factor of instability for Russia.
And I think, you know, this mutiny, this attempted rebellion, however you want to term that, in June was absolutely, you know, a threat to the Russian state. I don't think he intended to overthrow Putin. That seems to be the consensus. It was more like a bill of grievances, almost kind of medieval, the way it went down. But he was absolutely a threat to the stability of the country and to a lot of actors within the country, especially within the military. He had been increasingly vocal and really vitriolic in his attacks on the Russian military throughout the Ukraine war and in the weeks and days leading up to that mutiny in June. So he was certainly a threat to people and people's positions within Russia beyond just Putin himself.
Also, a Western reaction was that it really was not a surprise to hear this report of his death. Even President Biden, when asked about the plane crash and death of Prigozhin, that he would not be surprised to hear about this. So, though Putin was said to have made a very clear promise not to go after Prigozhin, and definitely defenders of Mr. Putin would say he usually stands by the personal promises that he makes. What are your thoughts on this?
You know, I think that, as you said, President Biden made that joke the other day, and I think a lot of people did. You know, the internet is filled with jokes about that Prigozhin shouldn't be standing next to a window, and jokes like that have been going on since the settlement of this mutiny in June, and a lot of people certainly expected that he was kind of a dead man walking, and it was just a matter of time. That being said, I mean, I think we can't ignore the possibility that he was killed by, assuming he's dead, he was killed by somebody besides Putin himself. You know, as I said, there are other actors in the Russian state, especially within the military, who want him dead. And there's also a kind of a technique of a wink and a nod. All of the people that have been killed, enemies of the Russian state, you know, that have been killed or enemies of Putin that have been killed since the early 2000s, have not necessarily been killed at Putin's direct order or by his hands. There's certainly a sense in which certain people, whether journalists or political opponents, Putin has maybe suggested they are troublesome or they're a problem, and that's been taken as carte blanche to have them killed by other actors within Russia, whether the Chechens, whether security state actors, the FSB, whether what's left of the Russian mafia. There are other possibilities beyond Putin himself directly ordering Prigozhin's death.
And also, there are always conspiracy theories when something like this happens to someone as controversial as Prigozhin. Is there any information indicating he could still be alive?
I mean, I haven't seen anything with any real substance to it, but I think people are going to speculate about that for absent of, you know, an identifiable body and hard definitive proof. I think that kind of speculation will continue for a while, given how closed off Russia is as a media environment, especially to people in the West, and the kind of crazy, almost sort of Hollywood story of Prigozhin's life and all of the Byzantine politics of Putin's Russia. It's certainly not outside the realm of possibility to think this is fake. I think Prigozhin's probably dead, but there's a reason there are speculations and theories the other way.
Will Prigozhin's death, if confirmed, mean an even bigger threat, as control will likely fall to Vladimir Putin?
It's an interesting thing. I think that, you know, this was never an independent actor. Prigozhin's mercenary army effectively was a tool of the Russian state, you know, through Russian military intelligence. He became an increasingly independent actor during the war in Ukraine as jockeyed for more power and influence, and as he was able to bring more to the table in terms of being able to put brigades, you know, really tens of thousands of troops into the field. And that spoke to the weakness of the Russian military and its manpower system. Wagner, I think, is most useful as an arm of the Russian state abroad and as providing a thin cover of plausible deniability in places like Syria and various parts of Africa. I think that'll probably continue, but there will be a process of consolidating control. And of course, we don't know what's gone on behind the scenes since that aborted mutiny in June that I've been referring to, in terms of who has really been calling the shots and what the degree of that truce and the control of that army effectively has been. So I think it could go in a couple of different ways. There's a question of effectiveness with Prigozhin out of the picture and whoever takes charge next.
What will this incident mean for Ukraine?
There's a question there about how useful Wagner was as a battlefield force going forward. And I think they were useful certainly in the battle for Bakhmut in particular and some of the fighting 6-9 months ago where the Russians really needed just bodies in uniform, needed to be able to throw manpower into a kind of grinding attrition battle for that city. And they were useful in that sense in really taking, for the most part, ex-convicts, putting them in uniform, emptying prisons in parts of Russia, putting guys in uniform and throwing them at the Ukrainians. The utility of that army, of that force for more kind of disciplined defensive warfare, which is what the Russians are doing now in the face of this Ukrainian offensive, that's more of an open question. I mean, those troops, I think, have not been in the front line in any meaningful way since before that rebellion. So they may be less useful going forward than they have been. They were kind of a stopgap in a lot of ways, provided needed forces as the Russian military was kind of at its low point about a year ago, a little bit more.
Gil Barndollar is a senior fellow at Defense Priorities. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis. The United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan says that it has recorded at least 218 extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan and hundreds of other serious human rights abuses since the Taliban seized power 2 years ago. I spoke with Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about the UN report.
We know that over the past 20 years, thousands of civilians and security forces have died while the U.S. was still in Afghanistan along with NATO forces. But since the Taliban took over in August 2021, the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, has been particularly focusing on the Taliban behavior towards members of the former Afghan government that was ousted and Taliban, you know, seized power. Because Taliban, as soon as they entered the capital, Kabul, 2 years ago, they announced a general amnesty for all members and security forces of the ousted government. So that's what prompted the United Nations to focus on whether Taliban live up to their commitment not to target members of the former government. So this is the first report they have formally prepared and come up with documenting these hundreds of human rights violations. Obviously, UNAMA has been in the country for many, many years. So they have their people on the ground who have been conducting these research reports and obviously in a covert manner because Taliban are really cracking down on NGOs and foreign groups working in Afghanistan. So, you know, it's quite a credible sort of reporting that the UNAMA has done over the years. And this is also something very serious that they have now reported about how the general amnesty that the Taliban announced 2 years ago is being violated and people of the former government are being targeted and executed.
As you point out, these are very, very serious human rights abuses and crimes that are taking place there. But the Taliban, they're denying this.
UNAMA also noted in its report that more than half of the deaths of former Afghan government members took place in the first 4 months after the Taliban seized control of the country. So that is a very significant acknowledgement on part of the United Nations, because those were the months when the Taliban were settling down and trying to establish their government and control over the country, a country which has seen war for many, many decades, and especially over the last 20 years, there have been so many groups fighting in Afghanistan. So during this volatile period of 4 or 5 months in the beginning, obviously Taliban were not in control of the country. It was a totally different country. After 20 years, Taliban were in control of Afghanistan 20 years ago. But this time when they took control of the country, it was totally a new situation for them. So they were really not in control of different provinces and their own security forces, which we call them security forces, but they were actually insurgents trained to fight a guerrilla war. So the Taliban were also a combination of different groups. So it seems that initially certain groups within the Taliban were trying to assert their authority in certain areas and maybe settling scores with the members of the former Afghan security forces who were conducting operations against Taliban insurgents with the help of the US and NATO forces at that time. So this is what the Taliban spokesman Zabiullah Mujahid, in reaction to UNAMA report today, indicated, that there were certain incidents which involved personal enmity or revenge actions, but those were in a very small number, limited number, such incidents. The rest of the allegations, the Taliban spokesman Zabiullah Mujahid rejected and demanded that the UN, if it has any documents and evidence about these human rights abuses, it should present it to the Taliban government so they can investigate and bring the culprits to justice.
Yes, and also these people that were in these groups, were they former army, police, and intelligence forces? And are they separated from different groups that have been killed?
According to the UN report, they were primarily members of the ANDSF, which is Afghan National Defense Security Force, that was trained and funded by the United States for almost 20 years. And they were armed also by the US military. So these are the personnel that the UN report says were, you know, targeted and killed or murdered in detention centers and during custody. But the Taliban simply denied that they have not targeted any former military officer just for his association with the previous government. But the Taliban have accepted one reality, and that is that there are certain individuals who were part of the U.S.-funded Afghan army, which does not exist anymore, but who have now joined a small resistance force which is waging an armed struggle against the Taliban government, and that they have arrested some of those people for challenging the Taliban authority, and they have even taken legal action against them. But the Taliban have not really clarified in their statement what kind of action has been taken against them. But we know that there is a resistance going on in certain parts of the country, and it is a known fact that in that resistance against the Taliban, special security forces that were trained by American military at the time have joined that resistance, and they have been off and on carrying out attacks against Taliban security forces.
That was Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. That's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more issues in the news. Until then, I'm Kim Lewis.